American Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans on the web at rwjf.org. In the forecast for tonight, clear and mild with lows in the 50s, mostly sunny with a high near 70 tomorrow, partly cloudy tomorrow night, lows in the 50s. It's 77 degrees in Boston.
Good evening. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. The industrialized nations of Europe have pursued the goal of a full employment economy for nearly 50 years. They all enjoy a social safety net that includes universal health care, and in times of layoffs, unemployment compensation close to the normal working wage for long periods of time. What about the American social safety net? Here, for the first time in a decade, a growing number of people are finding pink slips in their pay envelopes, even as the pay of the chief executives of many firms rises to 500 times that of the lowest paid worker. Is this fair or just? Does it even make economic sense? And what is the future of work in an increasingly technological age that is global in its reach? To assist us in answering these questions and to raise questions of their own, we welcome three distinguished guests. First, from the Boston University School of Management, Associate Professor of Management Policy, Susan Samuelson. Professor Samuelson earned a bachelor's degree and a law degree, both from Harvard University, and practiced law at Choate Hall and Stewart. Among her many published works are Business Law for a New Century and The Legal Environment for a New Century. Professor Samuelson, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Ted.
From the Fulcrum Resource Group, an executive search and team integration firm, President Harvey Widger, who has graduated from Temple University and earned an MBA in Business Administration from the University of Chicago. Among several upper management positions, Mr. Widger was Vice President for Human Resources at the Connors Publishing Company and Vice President for Management Development at American Express before founding his own firm. Mr. Widger.
Good afternoon, Ted.
And from Boston University, Dr. Thomas Cottle, Professor of Special Education at the Boston University School of Education, author of many works, including the just published The Trauma of Long-Term Unemployment, Hardest Times, and remembered well in this area as the host of many programs that probed into individuals' backgrounds and to issues of the day. Tom Cottle.
Hi, Ted. Good to see you.
Always. Good to have you with us. Well, let's start with a question that's right out of Econ 101. Why? Why does it seem that the first thing management does when there's even a hint of difficult times is lay off employees? What's the connection?
You have an increasingly financial-oriented economy, and you have people who aren't very sophisticated, maybe, about what creates value, and maybe the easiest thing to do in terms of showing effect on the bottom line is to lay people off. But then what happens?
I would agree with that perspective, that in a globalized economy, investors have many options of what they can do with their capital, and they're always looking for the highest return. And one way to affect the bottom line quickly is to cut expenses, and one way to cut expenses is payroll.
And I would just add that I think there's a sociological value, which is ours is not a culture which, in the main, honors the lives of human beings. So we would do it within our family, perhaps, but we don't necessarily do it in our business. If I'm running low in money in my family, I've cut a pay cut and I'm in difficult. The simplest thing to do would be just to orphan off one of my children. And if things get worse, I'll get rid of another one. And if it really gets worse, I'll dump my wife as well. Now, that is an absolutely absurd proposition. You're looking at me, Ted, like I'm out of my mind. But why would it be absurd in one part of the culture where it would be the knee-jerk reaction in another part of the culture to say, if we're short of money, if the profits are going down, the first thing we will do is not look out for our workers. We will get rid of some of our workers. So there's a certain value that we have that appertains to business, which is not always necessarily the valuing of men and women.
I would put it a slightly different way. Our society has always put great value on freedom to do whatever it is we want to do. And some people view one of those freedoms is freedom to hire and fire as we please. The traditional legal rule was called employment at will. And the rule traditionally was you can be fired for good reason, for no reason, or for a bad reason. That was the traditional rule, long since left in Europe. no longer the law in Europe at all. But in the United States, that was the traditional view. Now, there have been exceptions. We have federal statutes that prohibit discrimination, and there are some court cases that limit employers' right to fire. But that still is kind of the underlying principle of employment relationships.
Right. I totally agree, Susan. But my point would be that it's kind of, I believe in mom, apple pie, the flag, and liberty or freedom. But if you read a philosopher, for example, like John Rawls, the question would be, is what you're doing in your family, is what you're doing in your school, is what you're doing in your university, is what you're doing in your corporation just? Is it in any law, any theory of distributive justice, is that a just act?
Before we wander too far afield, though, from the human effects of this, let me ask you, Harvey, you work with companies that are mostly owner-operated, 50 to 100 employees. Is that the operative attitude when things pinch? Or is this something that belongs to shareholder-run companies, giant faceless corporations?
There are all kinds of trade-offs when you work in different levels of industry and different kinds of companies. But when you're working in a privately held, you're very much dependent, you know, on the values and the ideas and the beliefs of the person who runs the company. But I see far more evidence in those smaller companies of concern for the people. Because, you know, in a 50-person company or a 100-person company, the guy walks through the door, he sees everybody works for him, everybody knows his name, everybody knows about his foibles and his fancy car, and everybody knows about his family and vice versa. So there's far more loyalty to employees in smaller firms than there is to the larger ones. So that's on the plus side.
But you say it's financially driven now in a way that
it
wasn't
in the larger
before.
Companies. In the larger companies. When I first, my first job out of the University of Chicago was at Chase Manhattan Bank, and after on Wall Street. And after I was there for a couple of years, I was promoted and I became an officer of the bank, an assistant treasurer. And that allowed me to go to the officer's dining room and get a free lunch, which I thought was wonderful. And I remember one of the first discussions I had in the round table where the officers met so they could form teams or whatever the purpose of the officers' dining room was. One of the banks in New York had laid off officers. It was shocking. It was reverberating. It was as if the building would fall down because big companies didn't do that. Mm-hmm. Banks certainly didn't do that. Banks paid low but were loyal to their people. And that, in the 60s, was the beginning of a change of some kind. One of the first of many changes we've seen in the last 30 or 40 years in the world of work. But it was the beginning of the breakdown of the loyalty of larger companies, I think, to their employees.
So you talk about employment as will as always existing in the American psyche, and yet we're seeing changes in practice that are kind of bringing it into vogue, if you will, Professor Samuelson.
One of the major developments of the 20th century was the real separation between ownership and management with the rise of the large corporation. So we have shareholders who are the owners of the company, and their primary concern is their financial return. That's really their only connection with the company. We have other people associated with the company whom we call stakeholders, and that means employees, it means suppliers, it means the community affected by the where the organization operates. They have a different concern, and their concern is the viability of the company or the viability of their job. And interestingly enough, the research indicates that even for top officers in a company, even very highly paid people, what they really care about is keeping their job. So there's a fundamental conflict between the shareholders who say, fire people, just make sure my income is maximized, and employees of the company who say, what I really care about is keeping my job, even if it meant a pay cut. Mm.
But for the last 25 years or so, I mean, all I've been hearing about is the people that really know the work are the people who are doing the work. So let's eliminate middle management because those best able to do the job are the people doing the job. Now there seems to be a separation between top management. I see you smiling, Harvey.
Right.
Is this ringing a bell with you? Or?
Well, yes, but I'll strike a different theme, because when you started the show, you talked about how there's less loyalty, and the assumption was because there are more layoffs, it was all a bad thing. But one of the reasons, I think, for an employment at will philosophy is we're part of a capitalist system. We're seeking highest return. We have to adjust to changes. And one of the strengths of the American economy is its ability to adjust to changes. So I think, or the way I see the elimination of middle management, which I do think is going on, is that as we're trying to train our organizations to be more responsive to the market and preserve better relations with customers and be more efficient, we're finding that organizations work better if the people who do the work get involved in problem solving, not some guy analyst does the problem solving for them. So it's diminishing the value of middle management. On the other hand, it's strengthening organizations. So there are always these restructurings that go on as the economy learns to be more efficient and companies learn how to adjust to a world economy. So one of the strengths of an employment at will situation is it gives companies an opportunity to adjust to the market.
To the changing market.
Or they won't survive.
Well, in Europe, the first reaction to possible bad times does not seem to be to start laying off people. They're capitalist societies. Does economics work differently in Europe? Professor Samuelson?
Right. I don't think so. But the European economies have not done as well as the U.S. economy over the last number of years. And to many, to a large extent, the U.S. economy has been really a driving economy globally.
I agree with that, and yet the condition of the workers in some of these societies, which have not been doing so well, appears to be somewhat better in terms of...
You could have cited Japan as an example of an economy that encourages lifetime employment, at least for some of the workforce, and look what's happening there, because they can't adjust to their financial problems.
Well, the markets are down. They've clearly been in a recession, almost a depression, for about 10 years with zero growth. Their interest rates are down to zero. But the people are still doing okay, correct? I mean, I don't see bums on the streets when we see pictures of Tokyo. I believe that they're continuing to get health care and the resources that they need to live. And again, especially in Europe, where things may not have been as well run as here, but where they seem to... find a way to keep going. How do they do that?
Let me give you another example. Spain. Spain has lifetime employment, very high benefits, and the result is that employers are reluctant to hire full-time employees. So they have an enormous number of part-time temporary employees. That's the other side of the picture, that if employers are unable to lay off, then they don't hire as many people.
You know, almost like... adjunct teachers here in the United States, or
yes,
something like 10% of the workforce is temps in this country. In this country as well.
We've always had, for better or worse, a sort of winner-take-all philosophy that if you're really good at something, then you deserve to be well-paid and well-treated, and if you're not, then devil take the hindmost.
Question is, good at what? We had a recent example of somebody, a retail outlet, where Mrs. B used to be the name of the person that was known for it. It was taken over. The attempt was made to save it from bankruptcy. It went bankrupt, and the CEO walked away with $6 million. Good at what? Good for whom?
Well, you certainly would find a lot of support on the view that executive compensation is a bit out of control in this country. And, I mean, there was a recent case involving Disney, who hired Michael Ovitz from Hollywood, and he worked for the company for about 14 months and then it wasn't working out. He wasn't doing what the company needed for him to do, so he was let go. And his severance package was $140 million. And there was some shareholder sued, saying this is pretty outrageous. And the court, at trial, there was evidence that the board of directors actually did not know how high the amount would rise. Nonetheless, they approved the plan, and the court supported them in that.
Okay, so how does the market control Ovitz's pay?
That's a good question. The whole issue of executive compensation, effectively, in theory, the shareholders elect the directors, and the directors hire the officers and set their compensation. The reality is, in publicly traded companies in this country, is that the CEO effectively handpicks the board of directors. By and large, the CEO controls the nominating process, nominates people for the board, and then the shareholders have very little option and effectively elect whomever they're asked to elect. So there have been cases of fairly outrageous abuse by CEOs who are supported by their friends on the board. And Michael Eisner, for example, received $8 million. Michael Eisner, who is head of Disney, received $8 million stock options, which was the largest a grant of stock options that anyone could ever remember having happened. What he says is, look, while I've been head of Disney, market value of Disney has gone up by billions of dollars. I deserve this. And the reality is, if CEOs do well for their companies, they certainly are well rewarded. The reality also is, even if they don't do so well, they're often rewarded.
Disney has announced, what, 4,000 job layoffs within the last couple of weeks? My argument for the fellow wearing the Mickey Mouse costume, a man or woman, is that they too are contributing to the success of the corporation. Not maybe on the scale of an Ovitz, certainly not on the scale of an Eisner, but on a scale that may deserve continued employment. That's all. It's very confusing to me, and it may be confusing to our listeners. Harvey, explain it to us, will you? How does this work? How does the market drive a situation in which a very successful company, whose stock may have dipped because we're looking at the three-month bottom line, then lays off people who help make it a very successful company? How does this work?
I'll try to take a stab at answering that question, but then I'll tell you what I really feel after I try to answer your question. Every job has its own performance dimensions. And if someone puts on a Mickey Mouse costume every day, their job is to put on a costume and dance around, and there's not a lot of training involved, and the impact of their poor performance doesn't reverberate the way the impact of a CEO's poor performance would impact on the stockholders and the performance of the company. So when you hire a CEO, you're hiring somebody who knows his industry, who has some vision, who has some values, and hopefully will provide leadership that's going to grow the company and therefore grow the value of the enterprise. And, you know, if somebody does that, those skills are certainly of a higher order than the skills of somebody wearing a Mickey Mouse costume. And if somebody does that and does that well, they're certainly entitled to more money than somebody wears a Mickey Mouse costume. Now, the fact that we have multiples of 500 to 1 or 100 to 1 or whatever the difference between a CEO and the guy who wears the costume is in this country, well, those are bigger multiples and bigger spreads than other companies, countries.
Well, and more than 20 years ago, too.
And that's troubling.
Okay.
I would say this, not that I know about the economics of it. I think you, and my colleagues here are going to will straighten me out because they'll see what a radical I am. I just don't see that it's as rational as you're perhaps painting it, Ted. That is to say, I think the person that walks around with the Mickey Mouse costume could hardly make a claim that they could run the company, let's say, as an Eisner could run it, and or as Peter Lynch ran Fidelity. I think the guy that's talking to you on the phone is not Peter Lynch, and there was something magical about that one person. And may I say parenthetically, if you want to improve a high school, you go first into the principal's office. If a school is not doing well, dump that principal and get a new one, because that one person should be paid a fortune if they're doing, and I would offer you Debbie Meyer. But there's something irrational about it. There is something utterly irrational to pay Alex Rodriguez more money than you paid to buy the entire Texas Rangers baseball team. And while the guy that dresses up or the woman that dresses up in the Mickey Mouse costume can't make a claim that he or she is as important as Michael Eisner, when I get on an airplane, I am praying not only that this pilot, who I hope is happy, is making a lot of money, I am praying that some guy who earns very little money, got the rivets in right, that they got the gas, that they iced the wing, and that guy, to me, is as almost as valuable as that pilot. Because if the wing falls off, this pilot with his $180,000 a year salary. So I see a lot of the economy as utterly irrational, and I would say, as we always say facetiously, if it were rational, children, can you say teachers pay?
Comment, Professor Samuelson? Are we trying to make something rational out of what is essentially an irrational?
No, it's not. I'm not saying it is essentially irrational. I don't think
Wall Street
is essentially irrational, but I think that in certain, I don't think you can justify the Mike Ovitz situation. There is no rational way to justify it. You can't justify. If you can justify it in economic terms, then someone else can come along and say, how can you justify paying that guy a buyout of whatever it was, or Manny Ramirez, and pay the ushers so little? Aren't they human beings? Aren't they worthy people?
I think, as Harvey pointed out, though, the problem is that there are a lot of people who can dance in a Mickey Mouse costume. And for better or worse, we, or at least the board of directors of Disney, believes that there are not that many people who can increase the market value by billions. The other thing I'll say, that one thing that has happened, though, is that chief executive officers, heads of companies, have been fired more frequently in the last couple of years than had ever been the case before. And again, it speaks to sort of the shortened attention span of shareholders who say, we want our stock price up and we want it up now. And if you can't do, and we're willing to pay you virtually anything to have you do that. And if you can't do it, we'll try somebody else.
Okay, but these shareholders are really, you know, faceless. They'll tell you they have no power. They don't really elect the board of directors. I mean, you get a proxy in the mail or something, and you either sign it or not, whatever. So it's the market, really, that's demanding that the shares go up, isn't
it?
The share prices go up.
It's the institutional investors.
Okay.
So there is some shareholder power, which traditionally they really didn't exercise very much. But again, in the last 5 or 10 years, organizations like CalPERS, the California Pension Plan, or TIA CREF, the large teachers pension plan, have actually been going to companies and saying, you need to change the way you're operating because you're not maximizing shareholder value.
This might be a good time to ask if unemployment is purposely built into a current system. If you don't have a large pool of willing workers, inflation may start up again. That was one of the rationales for the Federal Reserve Chairman raising the rate 6 times in 13 months. He was fearful that inflation would begin because we had a virtually full employment economy.
Well, I wouldn't say it's purposely built in, but inevitably there will be a certain percentage of the workforce unemployed. People will be between jobs and things won't have worked out. And there's no doubt that having very high employment can be annoying. But I wouldn't go so far as to say that the current economic uncertainty is a plot on anyone's part to increase the supply of employees.
Harvey Wigger?
There's always this matter of expectations. We do know that even with the layoffs we may be having now, that the unemployment rates are as low as they've been in general forever. So what's that mean? It's sort of like things don't always fit together in a way you can understand. Just going back to the discussion we had a minute ago, I don't work with big corporations. I work with smaller companies, 10 million, 100-person companies. And the reason I like to work with them is because I like to work with owners who have values and are trying to build something, because it gives me a chance to be working to create something with them for the long haul. I'm often interviewing people who've come from larger companies, and the question is, why would you want to leave corporate America and go to a little company like this? And the answer is, for these people who are very results-oriented and want to make something happen and create something, if they go to a small company, they can do things. If they stay with a large company, it has to go up and get approved and approved, and people are saying no, and by the time something happens, it doesn't have their stamp on it, be it good or bad. So they go to a smaller company for the fun of working and creating something and seeing the results of what they do.
And then they get face-to-face with the people who are affected by their policies.
That's right.
And the human thing enters into the equation willy-nilly.
They have to – there's a higher level of commitment, you know, if the values are good. We all know experiences with, you know, egomaniacs and crazy people – you know, people nobody wants to be with, and they run business, and many of them are very successful. But they're also people who are trying very hard to be decent human beings who are running a business. And they're the folks that are fun to work with.
Are we wrong to assume that too many corporations jump for the layoff button when the stock drops or the economy turns sour? I know it's rewarded on Wall Street.
Yes. Well, there's some evidence in this most recent recession, if I can use the R word, that companies having just come out of such a tight labor market, and perhaps even still to some degree being in the tight labor market, are being a little bit more careful about, as you put it, pushing the layoff button. And there was just a report the other day about, oh, investment banks have decided that they're going to stop providing birthday cakes to all the investment bankers, and that will save $38,000, and therefore they may not have to lay off as many people. So it could be that there's a little bit more sensitivity.
Tom, I didn't find in reading Hardest Times, the Trauma of Long-Term Unemployment, any reason why any of these people should be out of work. Is the fact that we're working really a matter of luck?
Well, all of life is all of life. Any philosopher knows that part of life is luck. Rawls is wonderful. Rawls says nobody deserves anything, and that much of life is luck. And it is luck. It's lucky to have the parents that you had. It's lucky to have the grandparents. It's lucky to be born in a certain. It's lucky to have a father who this and a mother who that. A lot of it is luck. And why do some of these people have trouble getting back into jobs? I think what happens with a lot of the guys that I wrote about is that in the main, I guess I would argue that for a man, and probably more and more for women now too, their life is their work. They're almost interchangeable words, these two dirty four-letter words, life and work. And that when you strip a job away from a man, particularly a guy that's put in, he's 45, 50 years of age, which is the vulnerable time, he's put a lot of years into his work, and all of a sudden he gets what you was talking about before, the pink slip in the envelope. I'm using the word advisedly, he's traumatized. He has had no preparation for this. He has never imagined this happening. And he feels in trauma, which means an intense wound. All his life, he has heard, what are you going to be when you grow up, little boy? And at the cocktail party, we say, hi, Susan, what do you do? We dare not say to Susan anymore, are you married? Are you a mother? We say, what do you do? And then she says, I am raising two children. And then we say, oh, so you don't work. Right. So all of that stuff goes on. So we know the definitions of work. And I'm arguing for these guys, there is nothing to life other than to work. We could say, yeah, but you have a wonderful wife and you have wonderful kids. And they say, I cannot face these people as a husband and as a father unless I bring home the bacon. And these guys were traumatized and never recovered. In fact, I'm arguing that in their life, it was not a pink slip. It was a death notice. And they went off someplace to die. A couple of them committed suicide. Mm. One of them just disappeared off the face of the earth. I still don't know what has happened to this man. They were ill-prepared, given their family histories, given their psychic states. They were simply ill-prepared for the unemployment.
I'm Ted O'Brien. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. We're talking about what happens in the aftermath of layoffs and how they come about, and in this time where change is in the air, what people think about it. And we're doing that with Associate Professor of Management Policy Susan Samuelson from the Boston University School of Management, Harvey Widger from the Fulcrum Resource Group. He's president of the organization. They're an executive search firm and a team integration outfit, and he has had considerable experience in the upper reaches of corporate America with American Express and Connors Publishing, and Tom Cottle, a psychologist and a writer and author, and whose latest work is The Trauma of Long-Term Unemployment, Hardest Times. So what can we do about this situation? Let me read something in this connection. It's very brief. You've probably heard it before. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty. Now, what I see in those words...
Is that Saul Bellow?
It could have been. No. And as Barbara Jordan said, when We the People was written, her people were not included. So it's been a long road to get to where we are today. But what I see in those words, that state we're supposed to be about a people, a community, more perfect unity, common unity, justice, general welfare, peace, tranquility. How does unemployment advance any of those goals? Harvey?
The way you presented, we the people, it's sort of like, it's like a social contract that everybody should have full employment. I don't think that was the meaning of it. If you go to, let's say, our competitor, the Soviet Union, they guaranteed full employment, and we're full of stories about what their economy was like and why it failed. The whole frontier spirit that founded our country was based on our ability to adjust to change.
But we know that in any society, Europe, Japan, the Soviet Union, the United States, there are people who, for one reason or another, aren't able to adjust to change.
And that's, in that lies the solution. In other words, adjusting to change is a skill like any other. That's part of what we have to do. That's why the government has training. That's why corporations have outplacement. It's an economy that's geared to change. And because things are changing so much quickly, more quickly and a faster pace than they've changed before, the people who are comfortable with it and can adjust to it do better than the others.
Tom, you're looking not skeptical exactly, but pensive.
Well, I was listening to Harvey. What I was thinking about is how tragic it really is that we allow so many schools, I'm thinking of high schools, to pass so many children who come out of high school with a so-called diploma and practically not one single skill in their tool bag. We have these kids coming out, and they not only cannot adjust to the change, they don't really have fundamental skills
right.
to get into the market in the first place.
Right.
So, and now with the economy shifting, as Daniel Bell writes, we're now in this economy of consciousness where there's not even a product anymore. And here are these kids who can't read, who are literate in numeracy, who don't have fundamental skills. And then Harvey says, and wait, fella or lady, in 5 years, you're going to have to shift again. I haven't gotten the first shift down, sir. Well, I'm sorry. The world's going to pass you by. And I must say, in that regard, I think Dr. Silver's right. I think it's totally immoral to let these kids get through and not have a single skill. It's tragic because the ones with skills will shift, and they'll shift better at 55 with a good education than at 23
yeah.
or 40, whatever.
Yeah.
Harvey? I saw
Am
you
I wrong?
Nodding. You're nodding
no,
vigorously.
I agree. And it's one of the tragedies of big institutions because they lose their human values. Clinton, Bush, everybody has been talking about spending more money on education. You know, and in the end, it's a big buzzword and it's a slogan, but that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the fundamentals and the skills and being able to read and being able to see opportunities and go where it makes sense to go. So, you talk about Europe, for example, and having full employment, but people leave Europe to come here. So Germany, for example, when they were having their booms 10 years ago, imported people from Turkey and, you know, this place and that place because they didn't have enough workers. Meanwhile, we're constantly having to create more jobs because people are emigrating here. And there's always going to be an underclass, and the ones who lose are the ones who aren't educated, the ones who lose most.
This discussion reminds me a bit of a summer I spent working in a library in college, and it crossed my mind that life would be a lot easier if every book came the same size because then everything would fit neatly on the shelf. And the same is true with people. If everyone were well-educated and everyone had determination and everyone were willing to work hard, the world would be a better place.
Right.
The real question is how do we deal with people who don't meet these new and higher standards? And I don't think we have a great answer to that.
Well, the other thing is this. We may be at the lowest point in the unemployment statistics in years, but there are a lot of people who are not counted anymore. When the unemployment benefits run out, when they're out of the workforce for a certain year, when they're not looking, there could be millions of people that are not counted in any statistical abstract who are where these people
are. None of those people would be in the statistics. None of the people in that book would be in the statistics.
Yeah. So we have a hidden...
We have an underclass of people who are not well-educated or who, say, don't have the determination or whatever skills it takes to get and hold on to a job. And we always have to some degree, and we probably always will.
Okay, but it seems I'm sorry. Yes, that is true. But we have an enormous population called the working poor that William Julius Wilson, Catherine Newman write about gloriously. And there is at least one member of their family who is working full-time, often one and a half jobs, two jobs. They are working their you-know-what's off, and their children will escape poverty much quicker, much more frequently than the so-called hardcore, so-called ghetto poor, where there's nobody working. Those people are working very, very hard. They have no benefits.
And they have great determination. And they're working full-time at the minimum wage and are therefore below the poverty level in the United States.
Absolutely. But they have great determination, mm-hmm. and they want great things for their children.
But I think the people in your book, the ones you wrote about, are not the working poor, but people who have been laid off.
Some of them are working poor, mm-hmm. and were laid off.
Okay, another goal or vision, the utilitarian objective of the greatest good for the greatest number. Is that what we Americans were about, or did we only think we were about that? I mean, only today the greatest good seems to be, get $1 billion, but only 15,000 people can manage that out of the 260 million. What about that? Are we a society that looks for the greatest good for the greatest number, or have we lost that along the way?
I can't imagine we were ever a society that looked for the greatest good. I think we've always been a very competitive society. When you think of the founding of the country and the manifest destiny and
pursuit of liberty,
right?
Pursuit of happiness.
But that doesn't preclude a utilitarian theory.
It's really about the nature of man. The arguments you get in forming social policy about taxes or about unemployment are always about how it'll impact the ability of the economy to generate jobs. So the theory has been, if you generate jobs, you have a trickle down, and you get the most benefit for the most people. I mean, it's an imperfect situation. I mean, what would you propose? Let's look at it the other way. Would you propose that we pay everybody a salary of $20,000 a year for being human? And then let people choose whether or not they want to work?
I think that, in fact, that does work in some of the European countries we're talking about. The earned income tax credit is a step in that direction, a step in providing funds for people who may lack the necessities of life.
Exactly, and it's happening here in the United States.
Yes, in a small way.
Yeah. How big a way should it happen?
Well, I'm not here to answer the question. I mean, I'm here to ask them. But your point is a good one, that, starvation is not an option in the United States, or it shouldn't be.
Or it shouldn't be.
The question is, are we doing enough to prevent it in enough cases to be able to call ourselves a just society?
One of the questions that has often troubled me is sort of the issue of ethics in one's personal life and one's work life. Some people argue that behaving ethically is always profit maximizing. I think the evidence on that is that it's not. As a person, the most important thing or the only thing, and that how you live your life and the kind of impact you have in your community and how people remember you after you're gone are equally important. And I often say to my students, what do you want on your epitaph? Do you want it to be, this fellow sold more Jell-O Whip in Rochester, New York than any other living human being? Or can you think of something else that you would like to have on your epitaph? So I hope that in everyone's life there is someone, whether that someone is a teacher or a minister or a priest or whatever, who says to them, there are, in fact, things more important in your life than profit maximization.
Okay, but let's just step back for a moment and just view the society as a whole and try to take a look at the last 10 years especially. And I think we've seen a kind of a going away from that in, like, a big way, in the sense that the market almost spun out of control on more than one occasion. The top 20% were doing very well, the top 5% unbelievably well, and the 80% staying pretty flat from 73 to about 94. And then it began to come up a little bit.
we all have, it seems to me, we all have Toyotas, or there are a lot of Toyotas being sold, and Hondas, and Mercedes, and BMWs, and we all have large screen, flat screen televisions, and there's an awful lot of what seems to be the floor of people's lives that has changed and gone up.
I mean, the floor has been raised. My father had three suits and four pair of shoes, and now...
And everybody's working more, and they're buying more, but it's hard for me to see that we have less materially. I'm not sure about the spiritual side, but it's hard for me to say that the last 10 years that we're not living as well, at least economically.
But who is we, Harvey? I mean, we still don't have universal health care. Our infant mortality rate is still a scandal. It's about
Let's say the top 80% in terms of economics, and then I don't know about...
Among whites. It's among whites, it's the top 80%. Among blacks, it's the top 40%. The bottom 40%, the Federal Reserve divided the black and white populations in America into 20 percentiles. And they found out that the top 3 percentiles, 60% of the whites, actually have increased over the last decade and a half. The fourth one, I wish we had television here, I'm pointing to my ring finger, the fourth one didn't go anywhere. And the fifth one kind of dripped and drooped a little bit. Among the black population, the middle one, the middle 20 percentile, didn't go any place. The top two kind of went up, but the bottom two dropped. So there's a very large population of Hispanics and African Americans whose situation, even in a booming economy that we seem to have come out of, absolutely went down. I want to go back to something, and maybe my colleagues would disagree. I really do feel that America has been run according to a utilitarian concept in many ways. The greatest good for the most. We're doing the best we can. I would point to public education. We're doing very good with a lot of kids. We don't get them all. We miss a few. Please forgive me. The fact that the ones that we're missing typically are Hispanic and black, don't take it personal, but that's the way it seems, and I would say systematically that's what's happening. I don't think it's because people that run school boards or giant corporations are malicious, malevolent, fascistic people at all. I think they're doing the very best they can. I think everybody, every man and woman that's running a corporation in the United States would love to go to his or her employees and saying, we are doing so well, I'm just pasting on $10,000 for you. Have a wonderful Christmas. Why wouldn't they want to do that? They would love, they take care of themselves first. I probably would too if I was running the joint. But the fear that I have is that it has been a utilitarian function which has set people like the Rawlses and the Stephen Nathansons over at Northeastern University to say, how can you keep giving to A when it not only doesn't help B, that it hurts B, and Nathanson takes it, that's Rawls, and Nathanson takes it one step further. How can you give it to A until you bring B up to what he calls a level of decency? Can we really keep pouring money into this fabulous school when all of these kids are and their teachers are just having a horrendous time? New York City is a great example. The best salaries are not in New York City. They're outside of New York City. They're in Mamaroneck and Scarsdale. How are you going to attract these fabulous BU kids that I teach? And they're terrific, these women and these men. They're wonderful. How can I get them into the city schools of the United States when if they go to the suburban schools just outside, they'll make an additional $15,000 a year and not have to worry so much? That, to me, is part of the utilitarian theory. We're doing the best we can for the most. And for Rawls and Nathanson, it's simply not just.
So how would you solve this problem if you were czar of the universe? What would you do to
make schools?
Or to make sure that no child is left behind, as our president advocates?
What would I do in schools, in the school situations?
Well, we're talking about the unemployed and generally.
Well, what about universal health care? I mean, it's been a goal since 1945, for heaven's sake. Mm-hmm. Every other industrialized nation has it. Why should anybody go without health care in this society?
Well, you've talked about Europe. England has universal health care, and it's an absolutely unmitigated disaster.
Canada's right next door, and I don't think it's quite the disaster that it's painted. And isn't some medical care better than none?
Yes, clearly.
You know, New York State has more bureaucrats running education than there are bureaucrats in all of France. Now, So when I become czar of the universe, you can be darn sure one of the things that I'm going to do is I'm going to go to great corporations. I'm going to go to Stride Right Shoes. I'm going to go to these wonderful...
Wait, Tom, are you going to lay off bureaucrats?
You better believe I am. I am.
Your full employment economy.
I am going to lay them off. Yeah, I am going to lay them off. I'm going to send them to Harvey to get them retrained because I don't want 50 cents of a dollar in education going to the running of the bureaucracies.
See, Tom defined the issue differently. Then the world has gone to hell in a handbasket. You know, Tom said, we are doing better for a lot of us, but for some of us, we're not doing better. And let's focus on what has to be done for them. So in effect, I think Tom was talking about giving teachers incentives to gravitate there and working with them and simplifying it and making those educational organizations work better.
Yeah.
And I think that's right.
Okay. I really want to stress that I'm not sitting here as a Marxist. I'm sitting here as a guy that lost his shirt in the NASDAQ. I'm rooting for those guys to come back.
Yeah.
I'm rooting for Amen. General Electric. I think it's better for all of us when Wall Street has got that bullish grin. However, what I am saying is I personally want to move to the doing the best that we can for most to absolutely saying I don't want to rest comfortably until I see John Rawls and Stephen Nathanson smile and that we are saying this is a just
right.
culture
yeah.
and that we are not discriminating systematically against that same group of people generation in and generation out. Because I happen to be one of the lucky ones. I haven't earned all that much. I was very lucky. I picked my parents very, very well. Best decision I ever made. And it's true. I can't say it's because of my hard work and determination.
So essentially what we're talking about here when we're dealing with structural unemployment is let's do something about how the good is parceled out.
Well, distributed, exactly.
Yeah, distributive justice.
And Tom, what would you...
Go ahead.
What would
oh,
you
gosh,
do...
Oh, gosh, she's putting me on this spot.
I mean, about some of the people in your book. Again, if you were Czar of the Universe... What would you change?
Well, the things that I would want to change, if I could go back and change, I would definitely change a lot the education of a lot of these guys because mm-hmm. I think Harvey hit the nail on the head. Times change. You got to shift. You got to move. Can you move here? Can you move to the left? Can you take another job? And a lot of these guys couldn't.
Like the person you talked about who had dug telephone poles.
He's dead in the water.
Right.
He was dead in the water. Machines were taking over for him, he became immobilized by what he couldn't do. Well, so there's a psychic boost that's needed, a sociological boost that's mm-hmm. needed. I suppose there's the kind of childlike, wishful part of me that says if a guy's worked 20 years, isn't he entitled to some compensation that could go on and on and on?
And do you think compensation would have been enough?
No, but it would have rescued them from terrible, terrible struggles. But no, the rescuing is another job in which I can feel respect for myself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that a lot of this ought to be taught, in the school, the presentation skills, the essential means of communication that everybody needs now, the ability to regard yourself as a bundle of skills that can turn on a dime and be transferable. With the breakdown in the old, you asked what kind of social contract exists in this country. That's a good question. I think the old social contract was more like these small companies, where there was a face-to-face relationship between workers and management, and that a lot of that has gone by the boards.
Yes.
All right. So then the social contract is observable in the new generation who have no loyalty upward. You know, we're here to see what we can do, and then if that doesn't work, we'll go do it someplace else.
Of course, at the School of Management, we do teach people presentation skills and how to look for jobs and how to make career decisions. But people who make it to the School of Management they're not going to be the underclass that you describe in your book. Yeah. So perhaps what you're saying is as part of the educational system, beginning in elementary school I suppose one could say that our current educational system is along teaching general skills, but nothing very specific, and certainly very little is taught about particular career goals. So would you advocate starting at a fairly young age teaching?
Well, there's no question that teachers are teaching elementary kids, elementary students, and high school students how to speak, which raises a very, very complex question. And that is the problem that we find of African-Americans saying, I don't want to speak like you. I don't want your world. I don't want Whitey's world. And we have evidence now to suggest that a lot of African-American kids are holding back in the same way that we have evidence that girls are holding back generally. White girls are holding back in history because there's a feeling somehow that you're teaching us male history, and they're holding back. Here's a fabulous study, which I think relates, Susan, to what you're talking about. Claude Steele did a series of studies at Stanford and Michigan, two elite schools, great schools with great students. When he told them to take these particular tests, randomly selected kids, you know these studies, he said it's for academic attainment and achievement. Blacks did worse than whites. Women did worse than men. When he gave the same random sample of the same population, the exact same test, this is just an educational tool I'm working on. Blacks did as well as whites. Girls did as well as boys. So what does that say? It says that in addition to teaching, there's got to be something in our world that says to these African-American kids and these Hispanic kids, there is something waiting out there for you that you can accept that can be part of your life. So it's deeply problematic, and we pay a price of having sequestered certain populations of people for so long. They don't trust that if they work for a Fidelity or Gillette or these wonderful corporations, they might have a terrific life.
Okay. Final thoughts, Susan Samuelson, Professor Samuelson, on what we've talked about today. What haven't we talked about today?
Well, I was trying to think how I would summarize our discussion, and I haven't heard anyone rejecting the market system and saying it's not a bad idea, but what I have heard is a consensus that people need to be better prepared for competing in that market system, and the way to better prepare them is education, and certainly none of us sitting at the table would disagree with the importance of that approach.
Harvey, final thoughts?
I don't know how to bring values and compassion back in to our way of thinking about things. I don't think you do it by being czar of the world and paying everybody people and taking care of people who can't take care of themselves. But I would like to see us focus on training and helping the people who could be losers if they're not helped develop the skills to participate in our system.
And on that note, I'll thank you all. You've just heard a discussion of structural unemployment on Boston University's World of Ideas. Our guests have been Associate Professor of Management Policy Susan Samuelson, Harvey Wigder, President of the Fulcrum Resource Group, and Boston University Professor of Special Education Tom Cottle. Join us again next week.